Sometimes laughing from the jungle, sometimes shooting, sometimes screaming in the night. The little men who ain't there, Sullivan called them. There is nothing like them here, and his blindest day in Manhattan is not as dark as those nights after they lost the captain. Knowing this had been his advantage and those young fellows' mistake. He had simply raised his voice, speaking as a man might speak to a large room filled with old friends. "Say," he had exclaimed to the shadowy phantoms drifting slowly around him on the sidewalk. "Say, does anyone see a policeman? I believe these young fellows here mean to take me off." And that did it. Easy as pulling a segment from a peeled orange, the young fellows bracketing him were suddenly gone like a cool breeze. He only wishes he could solve the problem of Officer Wheelock that easily. 4:40 p.m. The Sheraton Gotham at 40th and Broadway is one of the largest first-class hotels in the world, and in the cave of its lobby, thousands of people school back and forth beneath the gigantic chandelier. They chase their pleasures here and dig their treasures there, oblivious to the Christmas music flowing from the speakers, to the chatter from three different restaurants and five bars, to the scenic elevators sliding up and down in their notched shafts like pistons powering some exotic glass engine, and to the blind man who taps among them, working his way toward a sarcophagal public men's room almost the size of a subway station. He walks with the sticker on the case turned inward now, and he is as anonymous as a blind man can be. In this city, that's very anonymous. Still, he thinks, as he enters one of the stalls and takes off his jacket, turning it inside out as he does so, how is it that in all these years no one has ever followed me? No one has ever noticed that the blind man who goes in and the sighted man who comes out are the same size and carrying the same case. Well, in New York, hardly anyone notices anything that isn't his or her own business. In their own way, they are all as blind Willie. Out of their offices, flooding down the sidewalks, thronging in the subway stations and cheap restaurants, there is something both repulsive and sad about them. They are like nests of moles turned up by a farmer's harrow. He has seen this blindness over and over again, and he knows that it is one reason for his success, but surely not the only reason. They are not all moles, and he has been rolling the dice for a long time now. He takes precautions, of course he does, many of them, but there are still those moments, like now, sitting here with his pants down, unscrewing the white cane and stowing it back in his case, when he would be easy to catch, easy to rob, easy to expose. Wheelock is right about the post. They would love him. They would hang him higher than Haman. They would never understand, never even want to understand, or hear his side of it. What side? And why has none of this ever happened? Because of God, he believes. Because God is good. God is hard, but God is good. He cannot bring himself to confess, but God seems to understand. Atonement and penance take time, but he has been given time. God has gone with him every step of the way. In the stall, still between identities, he closes his eyes and prays, first giving his thanks, then making a request for guidance, then giving more thanks. He finishes, as he always does, in a whisper only he and God can hear. If I die in a combat zone, bag me up and ship me home. If I die in a state of sin, close your eyes and take me in. Yeah, amen. He leaves the stall, leaves the bathroom, leaves the echoing confusion of the Sheraton Gotham, and no one walks up to him and says, "Excuse me, sir, but weren't you just blind?" No one looks at him twice as he walks out into the street, carrying the bulky case as if it weighed 20 pounds instead of 100. God takes care of him. It has started to snow, He walks slowly through it. Willie Shearman again now, switching the case frequently from hand to hand, just one more tired guy at the end of the day. He continues to think about his inexplicable success as he goes. There's a verse from the book of Matthew which he has committed to memory. They be blind leaders of the blind, it goes, and if the blind lead the blind, both shall fall into the ditch. Then there's the old saw that says, in the kingdom of the blind, the one-eyed man is king. Is he the one-eyed man? God aside, has that been the practical secret of his success all these years? Perhaps so. Perhaps not. In any case, he has been protected, and in no case does he believe he can put God aside. God is in the picture. God marked him in 1960, when he first helped Harry Doolin tease Carol and then helped Harry beat her. That occasion of sin has never left his mind. What happened in the grove of trees near Field B stands for everything else. He even has Bobby Garfield's glove to help him remember. Willie doesn't know where Bobby is these days and doesn't care. He kept track of Carol as long as he could, but Bobby doesn't matter. Bobby ceased to matter when he helped her. Willie saw him help her. He didn't dare come out and help her himself. He was afraid of what Harry might do to him, afraid of all the kids Harry might tell, afraid of being marked. But Bobby dared. Bobby helped her then. Bobby punished Harry Doolin later that summer, and by doing these things, probably just for doing the first of them, Bobby got well. Bobby got over. He did what Willie didn't dare to do. He rolled with it and got over, got well. And now Willie has to do all the rest, and that's a lot to do. Sorry is a full-time job and more. Why, even with three of him working at it, he can barely keep up. Still, he can't say he lives in regret. Sometimes he thinks of the good thief, the one who joined Christ in paradise that very night. Friday afternoon, you're bleeding on Golgotha's stony hill. Friday night, you're having tea and crumpets with the king. Sometimes someone kicks him. Sometimes someone pushes him. Sometimes he worries about being taken off. So what? Doesn't he stand for all those who can only stand in the shadows, watching while the damage is done? Doesn't he beg for them? Didn't he take Bobby's Alvin Dark model baseball glove for them in 1960? He did. God bless him, he did. And now they put their money in it as he stands eyeless outside the cathedral. He begs for them. Sharon knows. Exactly what does Sharon know? Some of it, yes. Just how much he can't say, certainly enough to provide the tinsel, enough to tell him he looks nice in his Paul Stewart suit and blue sulca tie, enough to wish him a good day and remind him to get the eggnog. It is enough. All is well in Willie's world, except for Jasper Wheelock. What is he going to do about Jasper Wheelock? Maybe I ought to follow you some night, Wheelock whispers in his ear, as Willie shifts the increasingly heavy case from one hand to the other. Both arms ache now. He will be glad to reach his building. See what you do. See who you turn into. What exactly is he going to do about Jasper the police smurf? What can he do? He doesn't know. 5:15 p.m. The young panhandler in the dirty red sweatshirt is long gone, his place taken by yet another street corner Santa. Willie has no trouble recognizing the tubby young fellow currently dropping a dollar into Santa's pot. "Hey, Ralphie!" he cries. Ralph Williamson turns. His face lights up when he recognizes Willie, and he raises one gloved hand. It's snowing harder now. With the bright lights around him and Santa Claus beside him, Ralph looks like the central figure in a holiday greeting card, or maybe a modern-day Bob Cratchit. "Hey, Willie, how's it going?" "Like a house afire," Willie says, approaching Ralph with an easy grin on his face. He sets his case down with a grunt, feels in his pants pocket, finds a buck for Santa's pot. Probably just another crook, and his hat's a moth-eaten piece of shit, but what the hell? "What you got in there?" Ralph asks, looking down at Willie's case as he fiddles with his scarf. "Sounds like you busted open some little kid's piggy bank." "Nah, just heating coils," Willie says. "About a damn thousand of them."
"You working right up until Christmas?"
"Yeah," he says, and suddenly has a glimmer of an idea about Wheelock. Just a twinkle, here and gone, but hey, it's a start. "Yeah, right up until Christmas. No rest for the wicked, you know." Ralph's wide and pleasant face creases in a smile. "I doubt if you're very wicked." Willie smiles back. "You don't know what evil lurks in the heart of the heating and cooling man, Ralphie. I'll probably take a few days off after Christmas, though. I'm thinking that might be a really good idea. Go south? Florida, maybe?" "South?" Willie looks startled, then laughs. "No, no," he says. "Not this kid. I've got plenty to do around the house. A person's got to keep their house in order, else it might come right down around their ears someday when the wind blows."
"I suppose." Ralph bundles the scarf higher around his ears. "See you tomorrow?"
"You bet," Willie says, and holds out his gloved hand. "Give me 5. Ralphie gives him 5, then turns his hand over. His smile is shy but eager. "Give me 10, Willie." Willie gives him 10. "How good is that, Ralphie, baby?" The man's shy smile becomes a gleeful boy's grin.
"So goddamn good, I gotta do it again," he cries,
and slaps Willie's hand with real authority. Willie laughs. "You the man, Ralph. You get over."
"You the man too, Willie," Ralph replies, speaking with a prissy earnestness that's sort of funny. "Merry Christmas."
"Right back at ya."
He stands where he is for a moment, watching Ralph trudge off into the snow. Beside him, the street corner Santa rings his bell monotonously. Willie picks up his case and starts for the door of his building. Then something catches his eye and he pauses.
"Your beard's on crooked," he says to the Santa. "If you want people to believe in you, fix your fucking beard." He goes inside.
PM. There's a big carton in the storage annex of Midtown Heating and Cooling. It's full of cloth bags, the sort banks use to hold loose coins. Such bags usually have various banks' names printed on them, but these don't. Willie orders them direct from the company in Moundsville, West Virginia, that makes them. He opens his case, quickly sets aside the rolls of bills. These he will carry home in his Mark Cross briefcase, then fills 4 bags with coins. In a far corner of the storage room is a battered old metal cabinet simply marked parts. Willie swings it open, there is no lock to contend with, and reveals another 100 or so coin-stuffed bags. A dozen times a year, he and Sharon tour the Midtown churches, pushing these bags through the contribution slots or hinged package delivery doors when they will fit, simply leaving them by the door when they won't. The lion's share always goes to St. Pat's, where he spends his days wearing dark glasses and a sign. But not every day, he thinks, now undressing. I don't have to be there every day. And he thinks again that maybe Bill, Willie, and Blind Willie Garfield will take the week after Christmas off. In that week, there might be a way to handle Officer Wheelock, to make him go away. Except,
I can't kill him. He says in a low, nagging voice. I'll be fucked if I kill him. Only, fucked isn't what he's worried about. Damned is what he's worried about. Killing was different in Vietnam, or seemed different, but this isn't Vietnam, isn't the green. Has he built these years of penance just to tear them down again? God is testing him, testing him, testing him. There is an answer here. He knows there is. There must be. He is just, ha-ha, pardon the pun, too blind to see it. Can he even find the self-righteous son of a bitch? Shit, yeah, that's not the problem. He can find Jasper the police smurf, all right, just about any old time he wants.
trail him right to wherever it is that he takes off his gun and his shoes and puts his feet up on the hassock. But then what? He worries at this, as he uses cold cream to remove his makeup, and then he puts his worries away. He takes the November through December ledger out of its drawer, sits at his desk, and for 20 minutes he writes, "I am heartily sorry for hurting Carol." He fills an entire page, top to bottom and margin to margin. He puts it back, then dresses in Bill Shearman's clothes. As he is putting away Blind Willie's boots, his eye falls on the scrapbook with its red leather cover. He takes it out, puts it on top of the file cabinet, and flips back the cover with its single word, "Memories," stamped in gold. On the first page is the certificate of a live birth, William Robert Shearman, born January 4, 1946, and his tiny footprints. On the following pages are pictures of him with his mother, pictures of him with his father, Pat Shearman smiling as if he had never pushed his son over in his high chair or hit his wife with a beer bottle. Pictures of him with his friends. Harry Doolin is particularly well represented. In one snapshot, 8-year-old Harry is trying to eat a piece of Willie's birthday cake with a blindfold on, a forfeit in some game, no doubt. Harry's got chocolate smeared all over his cheeks. He's laughing and looks as if he doesn't have a mean thought in his head. Willie shivers at the sight of that laughing, smeary, blindfolded face. It almost always makes him shiver. He flips away from it, toward the back of the book, where he's put the pictures and clippings of Carol Gerber he has collected over the years. Carol with her mother. Carol holding her brand new baby brother and smiling nervously. Carol and her father, him in navy dress blue and smoking a cigarette, her looking up at him with big wonderstruck eyes. Carol on the JV cheering squad at Harwich High her freshman year, caught in mid-leap with one hand waving a pom-pom and the other holding down her pleated skirt. Carol and John Sullivan on tinfoil thrones at Harwich High in 1965, the year they were elected Snow Queen and Snow King at the junior-senior prom. They look like a couple on a wedding cake. Willie thinks this every time he looks at the old yellow newsprint. Her gown is strapless, her shoulders flawless. There is no sign that for a little while, once upon a time, the left one was hideously deformed, sticking up in a witch-like double hump. She had cried before that last hit, cried plenty, but mere crying hadn't been enough for Harry Doolin. That last time he had swung from the heels, and the smack of the bat hitting her had been like the sound of a mallet hitting a half-thawed roast. And then she had screamed, screamed so loud that Harry had fled without even looking back to see if Willie and Richie O'Meara were following him. Took to his heels, had old Harry Doolin, ran like a jackrabbit. But if he hadn't? Suppose that, instead of running, Harry had said, "Hold her, guys, I ain't listening to that, I'm going to shut her up," meaning to swing from the heels again, this time at her head? Would they have held her? Would they have held her for him even then? "You know you would have," he thinks dully. "You do penance as much for what you were spared as for what you actually did, don't you?" Here's Carol Gerber in her graduation gown, spring 1966, it's marked. On the next page is a news clipping from the Harwich Journal marked fall 1966. The accompanying picture is her again, but this version of Carol seems a million years removed from the young lady in the graduation gown, the young lady with the diploma in her hand, the white pumps on her feet, and her eyes demurely downcast. This girl is fiery and smiling. These eyes look straight into the camera. She seems unaware of the blood coursing down her left cheek. She is flashing the peace sign. This girl is on her way to Danbury already. This girl has got her Danbury dancing shoes on. People died in Danbury. The guts flew, baby. And Willie does not doubt that he is partly responsible. He touches the fiery, smiling, bleeding girl with her sign that says, "Stop the murder," only instead of stopping it, she became a part of it. And knows that in the end, Her face is the only one that matters. Her face is the spirit of the age. 1960 is smoke. Here is fire. Here is death with blood on her cheek and a smile on her lips and a sign in her hand. Here is that good old Danbury dementia. The next clipping is the entire front page of the Danbury paper. He has folded it 3 times so it will fit in the book. The biggest of 4 photos shows a screaming woman standing in the middle of a street and holding up her bloody hands. Behind her is a brick building which has been cracked open like an egg. Summer 1970, he has written beside it. 6 dead, 14 injured in Danbury bomb attack. Radical group claims responsibility. No one meant to be hurt, female caller tells police. The group, Militant Students for Peace, they called themselves, planted the bomb in a lecture hall on the Danbury UConn campus. On the day of the explosion, Coleman Chemicals was holding job interviews there between 10 a.m. and 4 p.m. The bomb was apparently supposed to go off at 6 in the morning when the building was empty. It failed to do so. At 8 o'clock, then again at 9, someone, presumably someone from the MSP, called campus security and reported the presence of a bomb in the first floor lecture hall. There were cursory searches and no evacuation. This was our 83rd bomb threat of the year, an unidentified campus security officer was quoted as saying. No bomb was found, although the MSP later claimed vehemently that the exact location, the air conditioning duct on the left side of the hall, had been given. There was evidence, persuasive evidence to Willie Shearman if to no one else, that at 12:15, while the job interviews were in recess for lunch, a young woman made an effort, at considerable risk to her own life and limb, to retrieve the UXB herself. She spent perhaps 10 minutes in the then vacant lecture hall before being led away, protesting, by a young man with long black hair. The janitor who saw them later identified the man as Raymond Fiegler, head of the MSP. He identified the young woman as Carol Gerber. At 2:10 that afternoon, the bomb finally went off. God bless the living, God bless the dead. Willie turns the page. Here is a headline from the Oklahoma City Oklahoman, April of 1971. 3 radicals killed in roadblock shootout. Big fish may have escaped by minutes, says FBI SAC Thurman. The big fish were John and Sally McBride, Charlie Duck Golden, the elusive Raymond Fiegler, and Carol, the remaining members of the MSP, in other words. The McBrides and Golden died in Los Angeles 6 months later, someone in the house still shooting and tossing grenades even as the place burned down. Neither Fiegler nor Carol was in the burned-out shell, but the police techs found large quantities of spilled blood, which had been typed AB positive, a rare blood type, Carol Gerber's blood type. Dead or alive or dead, not a day goes by that Willie doesn't ask himself this question. He turns to the next page of the scrapbook, knowing he should stop. He should get home. Sharon will worry if he doesn't at least call. He will call. From downstairs he will call. She's right. He's very dependable. But he doesn't stop just yet. The headline over the photo showing the charred skull of the house on Benefit Street is from the Los Angeles Times. 3 of Danbury 12 die in East L.A. Police speculate murder-suicide pact. Only Fiegler, Gerber, unaccounted for. Except the cops believed Carol, at least, was dead. The piece made that clear. At the time, Willie had also been convinced it was so. All that blood. Now, however, dead or alive? Alive or dead? Sometimes his heart whispers to him that the blood doesn't matter. That she got away from that small frame house long before the final acts of insanity were committed there. At other times, he believes what the police believe, that she and Fiegler slipped away from the others only after the first shootout, before the house was surrounded, that she either died of wounds suffered in that shootout or was murdered by Fiegler because she was slowing him down. According to this scenario, the fiery girl with the blood on her face and the sign in her hand is probably now just a bag of bones, cooking in the desert somewhere east of the sun and west of Tonopah. Willie touches the photo of the burned-out house on Benefit Street, and suddenly a name comes to him, the name of the man who maybe stopped Dong Ha from becoming another Mi Lai or Mai Ki. Slocum. That was his name, all right. It's as if the blackened beams and broken windows have whispered it to him. Willie closes the scrapbook and puts it away, feeling at peace. He finishes squaring up what needs to be squared up in the offices of Midtown Heating and Cooling, then steps carefully through the trap door and finds his footing on top of the stepladder below. He takes the handle of his briefcase and pulls it through. He descends to the third step, then lowers the trap door into place and slides the ceiling panel back where it belongs. He cannot do anything permanent to Officer Jasper Wheelock. But Slocum could. Yes, indeed, Slocum could. Of course, Slocum was black, but what of that? In the dark, all cats are gray, and to the blind, they're no color at all. Is it really much of a reach from blind Willie Garfield to blind Willie Slocum? Of course not. Easy as breathing, really. Do you hear what I hear? He sings softly as he folds the stepladder and puts it back. Do you smell what I smell? Do you taste what I taste? 5 minutes later, he closes the door of Western States Land Analysts firmly behind him and triple locks it. Then he goes down the hallway. When the elevator comes and he steps in, he thinks, eggnog, don't forget, the Allens and the Dubrays. Also cinnamon, he says out loud. The three people in the elevator car with him look around, and Bill grins self-consciously. Outside, he turns toward Grand Central, registering only one thought as the snow beats full into his face and he flips up his coat collar. The Santa outside has fixed his beard. Midnight. Cher? Hmm? Her voice is sleepy, distant. They have made long, slow love after the Dubrays finally left at 11 o'clock, and now she is drifting away. That's all right. He is drifting, too. He has a feeling that all his problems are solving themselves, or that God is solving them. I may take a week or so off after Christmas, do some inventory, poke around some new sites. I'm thinking about changing locations. There is no need for her to know about what Willie Slocum may be doing in the week before New Year's. She couldn't do anything but worry, and perhaps, perhaps not, he sees no reason to find out for sure. Feel guilty. Good, she says. See a few movies while you're at it, why don't you? Her hand gropes out of the dark and touches his arm briefly. You work so hard. Pause. Also, you remember the eggnog. I really didn't think you would. I'm very pleased with you, sweetheart. He grins in the dark at that, helpless not to. It is so perfectly Sharon. The Allens are all right, but the Dubrays are boring, aren't they? She asks. A little, he allows. If that dress of hers had been cut any lower, she could have gotten a job in a topless bar. He says nothing to that, but grins again. It was good tonight, wasn't it? She asks him. It's not their little party that she's talking about. Yes, excellent. Did you have a good day? I didn't have a chance to ask. Fine day, Cher. I love you, Bill. Love you, too. Good night. Good night. As he drifts towards sleep, he thinks about the man in the bright red ski sweater. He crosses over without knowing it, thought melting effortlessly into dream. 69 and 70 were the hard years, the man in the red sweater says, I was at Hamburger Hill with the 3-187. We lost a lot of good men. Then he brightens. But I got this. From the left-hand pocket of his topcoat, he takes a white beard hanging on a string. And this. From the right-hand pocket, he takes a crumpled styrofoam cup, which he shakes. A few loose coins rattle in the bottom, like teeth. So you see, he says, fading now, there are compensations for even the blindest light. Then the dream itself fades, and Bill Shearman sleeps deeply until 6:15 the next morning, when the clock radio wakes him to the sound of the little drummer boy.
"1999, when someone dies, you think about the past. Why we're in Vietnam. When someone dies, you think about the past. Sully had probably known this for years, but it was only on the day of Pags's funeral that it formed in his mind as a conscious postulate. It was 26 years since the helicopters took their last loads of refugees, some dangling photogenically from the landing skids, off the roof of the U.S. Embassy in Saigon, and almost 30 since a Huey evac'd John Sullivan, Willie Shearman, and maybe a dozen others out of Dong Ha province. Sully John and his magically refound childhood acquaintance had been heroes that morning when the choppers fell out of the sky. They'd been something else come afternoon. Sully could remember lying there on the Huey's throbbing floor and screaming for someone to kill him. He could remember Willie screaming as well. "I'm blind," was what Willie had been screaming. "Ah, Jesus, fuck, I'm blind." Eventually, it had become clear to him, even with some of his guts hanging out of his belly in gray ropes and most of his balls blown off, that no one was going to do what he asked and he wasn't going to be able to do the job on his own. Not soon enough to suit him, anyway. So he asked someone to get rid of the Mama-san. They could do that much, couldn't they? Land her? Or just dump her the fuck out? Why not? Wasn't she dead already? Thing was, she wouldn't stop looking at him. And enough was enough. By the time they swapped him and Shearman and half a dozen others, the worst ones, to a medevac at the rally point everyone called PP City, the chopper jockeys were probably damn glad to see them go, all that screaming. Sully had started to realize none of the others could see old Mama-san squatting there in the cockpit, old white-haired Mama-san in the green pants and orange top and those weird, bright Chinese sneakers, the ones that looked like Chuck Taylor high tops, bright red, wow. Old Mama-san had been Malenfant's date, old Mr. Card Shark's big date. Earlier that day, Malenfant had run into the clearing along with Sully and Diefenbaker and Sly Slocum and the others, never mind the gooks firing at them out of the bush, never mind the terrible week of mortars and snipers and ambushes. Malenfant had been hero-bound, and Sully had been hero-bound, too. And now, oh, hey, look at this. Ronnie Malenfant was a murderer. The kid Sully had been so afraid of back in the old days had saved his life and been blinded, and Sully himself was lying on the floor of a helicopter with his guts waving in the breeze. As Art Linkletter always said, it just proved that people are funny. "Somebody kill me," he had screamed on that bright and terrible afternoon. "Somebody shoot me, for the love of God, just let me die." But he hadn't died. The doctors had managed to save one of his mangled testicles, and now there were even days when he felt more or less glad to be alive. Sunsets made him feel that way. He liked to go out to the back of the lot where the cars they'd taken in trade but hadn't yet fixed up were stored, and stand there watching the sun go down. Corny shit, granted, but it was still the good part. In San Francisco, Willie was on the same ward, and visited him a lot until the Army in its wisdom sent First Lieutenant Sherman somewhere else. They had talked for hours about the old days in Harwich and people they knew in common. Once they'd even gotten their picture taken by an AP news photographer, Willie sitting on Sully's bed, both of them laughing. Willie's eyes had been better by then, but still not right. Willie had confided to Sully that he was afraid they never would be right. The story that went with the picture had been pretty dopey, but had it brought them letters? Holy Christ, more than either of them could read. Sully had even gotten the crazy idea that he might hear from Carol. But of course, he never did. It was the spring of 1970, and Carol Gerber was undoubtedly busy smoking pot and giving blowjobs to end-the-war hippies while her old high school boyfriend was getting his balls blown off on the other side of the world. That's right, Art. People are funny. Also, kids say the darndest things. When Willie shipped out, old Mama-san stayed. Old Mama-san hung right in there. During the 7 months Sully spent in San Francisco's Veterans Hospital, she had come every day and every night, his most constant visitor in that endless time, when the whole world seemed to smell of piss and his heart hurt like a headache. Sometimes she showed up in a muumuu like the hostess at some nutty luau. Sometimes she came wearing one of those grisly green golf skirts and a sleeveless top that showed off her scrawny arms, but mostly she wore what she had been wearing on the day Malenfant killed her. The green pants, the orange smock, the red sneakers with the Chinese symbols on them. One day that summer he unfolded the San Francisco Chronicle and saw his old girlfriend had made the front page. His old girlfriend and her hippie pals had killed a bunch of kids and job recruiters back in Danbury. His old girlfriend was now Red Carol. His old girlfriend was a celebrity. "You cunt," he had said, as the paper first doubled, then trebled, then broke up into prisms. "You stupid, fucked-up cunt." He had balled the paper up, meaning to throw it across the room, and there was his new girlfriend. There was old Mama-san sitting on the next bed, looking at Sully with her black eyes. And Sully had broken down completely at the sight of her. When the nurse came, Sully either couldn't or wouldn't tell her what he was crying about. All he knew was that the world had gone insane, and he wanted a shot. And eventually the nurse found a doctor to give him one, and the last thing he saw before he passed out was Mama-san, old fucking Mama-san, sitting there on the next bed with her yellow hands in her green polyester lap, sitting there and watching him. She made the trip across the country with him, too, had come all the way back to Connecticut with him, deadheading across the aisle in the tourist cabin of a United Airlines 747. She sat next to a businessman who saw her no more than the crew of the Huey had, or Willie Sherman, or the staff at the Pussy Palace. She had been Malenfant's date in Dong Ha, but she was John Sullivan's date now, and never took her black eyes off him. Her yellow wrinkled fingers always stayed folded in her lap, and her eyes always stayed on him. 30 years. Man, that was a long time. But as those years went by, Sully had seen her less and less. When he returned to Harwich in the fall of 70, he saw old Mama-san just about every day, eating a hot dog in Commonwealth Park by Field B or standing at the foot of the iron steps leading up to the railway station where the commuters ebbed and flowed, or just walking down Main Street, always looking at him. Once, not long after he'd gotten his first post-Vietnam job, selling cars, of course, it was the only thing he really knew how to do. He had seen old Mama-san sitting in the passenger seat of a 1968 Ford LTD with "Price to Sell" soaped on the windshield. "You'll start to understand her in time," the head shrinker in San Francisco had told him, and refused to say much more no matter how hard Sully pressed him. The shrink wanted to hear about the helicopters that had collided and fell out of the sky. The head shrinker wanted to know why Sully so often referred to Mellonfont as that card-playing bastard. Sully wouldn't tell him. The head shrinker wanted to know if Sully still had sexual fantasies, and if so, had they become noticeably violent. Sully had sort of liked the guy, Conroy his name was, but that didn't change the fact that he was an asshole. Once, near the end of his time in San Francisco, he had come close to telling Dr. Conroy about Carol. On the whole, he was glad he hadn't. He didn't know how to think about his old girlfriend, let alone talk about her. Conflicted was Conroy's word for this state. He had called her a stupid, fucked-up cunt, but the whole damn world was sort of fucked up these days, wasn't it? And if anyone knew how easily violent behavior could break its leash and just run away, John Sullivan did. All he was sure of was that he hoped the police wouldn't kill her when they finally caught up to her and her friends. Asshole or not, Dr. Conroy hadn't been entirely wrong about Sully coming to understand old Mama-san as time went by. The most important thing was understanding, on a gut level, that old Mama-san wasn't there. Head knowledge of that basic fact was easy, but his gut was slower to learn, possibly because his gut had been torn open in Dong Ha, and a thing like that just had to slow the understanding process down. He had borrowed some of Dr. Conroy's books, and the hospital librarian had gotten him a couple of others on interlibrary loan. According to the books, old Mama-san in her green pants and orange top was an externalized fantasy which served as a coping mechanism to help him deal with his survivor guilt and post-traumatic stress syndrome. She was a daydream, in other words. Whatever the reasons, his attitude about her changed as her appearances became less frequent. Instead of feeling revulsion or a kind of superstitious dread when she turned up, he began to feel almost happy when he saw her. The way you felt when you saw an old friend who had left town but sometimes came back for a little visit. He lived in Milford now, a town about 20 miles north of Harwich on I-95 and light years away in most other senses. Harwich had been a pleasant, tree-filled suburb when Sully lived there as a kid, chumming with Bobby Garfield and Carol Gerber. Now his old hometown was one of those places you didn't go at night, just a grimy adjunct to Bridgeport. He still spent most of his days there. On the lot or in his office, Sullivan Chevrolet had been a Gold Star dealership 4 years running now. But he was gone by 6 o'clock most evenings, 7 for sure, tooling north to Milford in his Caprice demonstrator. He usually went with an unacknowledged but very real sense of gratitude. On this particular summer day, he had gone south from Milford on I-95 as usual, but at a later hour and without getting off, at exit 9, Asher Avenue, Harwich. Today he had kept the new demo pointed south. It was blue, with black wall tires, and watching people's brake lights go on when they saw him in their rearview mirrors never failed to amuse him. They thought he was a cop. And drove all the way into New York City. He left the car at Arnie Mossberg's dealership on the west side. When you were a Chevy dealer, there was never a parking problem. That was one of the nice things about it. Did some window shopping on his way across town, had a steak at Palm 2, then went to Pagano's funeral. Pags had been one of the guys at the chopper crash site that morning, one of the guys in the Ville that afternoon. Also one of the guys caught in the final ambush on the trail, the ambush which had begun when Sully himself either stepped on a mine or broke a wire and popped a satchel charge strapped to a tree. The little men in the black pajamas had been in the high toolies, and man, they had opened up. On the trail, Pags had grabbed Walensky when Walensky got shot in the throat. He got Walensky into the clearing, but by then, Walensky was dead. Pags would have been covered with Walensky's blood. Sullivan didn't actually remember seeing that. He had been in his own hell by then. But that was probably something of a relief to the man because it covered up the other blood, still not entirely dry. Pagano had been standing close enough to get splattered when Slocum shot Malenfant's buddy. Splattered with Clemson's blood. Splattered with Clemson's brains. Sully had never said a word about what happened to Clemson in the Ville. Not to Dr. Conroy or anyone else. He had dummied up. All of them had dummied up. Pags had died of cancer. Whenever one of Sully's old Nam buddies died, well, okay, they weren't buddies exactly, most of them dumb as stone boats and not what Sully would really call buddies, but it was the word they used because there was no word invented for what they had really been to each other. It always seemed to be cancer or drugs or suicide. Usually the cancer started in the lung or the brain and then just ran everywhere, as if these men had left their immune systems back in the green. With Dick Pagano, it had been pancreatic cancer, him and Michael Landon. It was the disease of the stars. The coffin was open, and old Pags didn't look too shabby. His wife had had the undertaker dress him in an ordinary business suit, not a uniform. She probably hadn't even considered the uniform option, despite the decorations Pagano had won. Pags had worn a uniform for only 2 or 3 years. Those years like an aberration, like time spent in some county joint because you did something entirely out of character on one bad luck occasion, probably while you were drunk. Killed a guy in a barroom fight, say, or took it into your head to burn down the church where your ex-wife taught Sunday school. Sully couldn't think of a single man he'd served with, including himself, who would want to be buried in an army uniform. Diefenbaker, Sully still thought of him as the new lieutenant, came to the funeral. Sully hadn't seen Diefenbaker in a long time, and they had had themselves quite a talk. Although Diefenbaker actually did most of the talking. Sully wasn't sure talking ever made a difference, but he kept thinking about the stuff Diefenbaker said, how mad Diefenbaker had sounded, mostly. All the way back to Connecticut, he kept thinking about it. He was on the Triborough Bridge heading north again by 2 o'clock, in plenty of time to beat the rush hour traffic. Smooth movement across the Triborough and the key points along the LIE was how the traffic reporter on the WINS copter put it. That's what copters were for these days, gauging the flow of traffic in and out of America's cities. When the traffic started to slow just north of Bridgeport, Sully didn't notice. He had switched from news to oldies and had fallen to thinking about Pags and his harmonicas. It was a war movie cliché. The grizzled G.I. with the mouth harp, but Pagano, dear God, Pagano could drive you out of your ever-fucking mind. Night and day he had played him, until one of the guys, it might have been Hexley or even Garrett Slocum, told him that if he didn't quit it, he was apt to wake up one morning with the world's first whistling rectal implant. The more he considered it, the more Sully thought Sly Slocum had been the one to threaten the rectal implant. Big black man from Tulsa. Thought Sly and the Family Stone was the best group on earth, hence the nickname, and refused to believe that another group he admired, Rare Earth, was white. Sully remembered Deef. This was before Diefenbaker became the new lieutenant and gave Slocum that nod, probably the most important gesture Diefenbaker had ever made or ever would make in his life. Telling Slocum that those guys were just as white as fucking Bob Dylan. The folk singing honky was what Slocum called Dylan. Slocum thought this over, then replied with what was for him rare gravity, the fuck you say. Rare earth men, those guys black. They record on fucking Motown and all Motown groups are black, everyone know that. Supremes, fucking Temps, Smokey Robinson, and the Miracles, I respect you, Deef. You bad, and you nationwide, without a doubt, man. But if you persist in your bullshit, I'm gonna knock you down. Slocum hated harmonica music. Harmonica music made him think of the folk singing honky. If you tried to tell him that Dylan cared about the war, Slocum asked then, how come the Mule Bray motherfucker didn't come on over here with Bob Hope one time? I'll tell you why, Slocum said. He's scared, that's why. Fucking candy-ass harmonica-blowing Mule Bray motherfucker. Musing on Diefenbaker, rapping about the 60s, thinking of those old names and old faces and old days. Not noticing as the Caprice's speedometer dropped from 60 to 50 to 40, the traffic starting to stack up in all four northbound lanes. He remembered how Pags had been over there in the green, skinny, black-haired, his cheeks still dotted with the last of his post-adolescent acne, a rifle in his hands, and two Hohner harmonicas, one key of C, one key of G, stuffed into the waistband of his camo trousers 30 years ago that had been. Roll back 10 more, and Sully was a kid, growing up in Harwich, palling with Bobby Garfield and wishing that Carol Gerber would look at him, John Sullivan, just once, the way she always looked at Bobby. In time she had looked at him, of course, but never in quite the same way. Was it because she was no longer 11, or because he wasn't Bobby? Sully didn't know. The look itself had been a mystery. It seemed to say that Bobby was killing her, and she was glad. She would die that way, until the stars fell from the sky and the rivers ran uphill and all the words to Louie Louie were known. What had happened to Bobby Garfield? Had he gone to Vietnam? Joined the Flower Children? Married, fathered children, died of pancreatic cancer? Sully didn't know. All he knew for sure was that Bobby had changed somehow in the summer of 1960. The summer Sully had won a free week at the YMCA camp on Lake George and had left town with his mother. Carol had stayed through high school, and even if she had never looked at him quite the way she had looked at Bobby, he had been her first, and she his. One night, out in the country behind some Newburgh dairy farmer's barn full of lowing cattle, Sully remembered smelling sweet perfume on her throat as he came. Why that odd cross-connection between Pagano and his coffin and the friends of his childhood? Perhaps because Pags had looked a little bit like Bobby had looked in those bygone days. Bobby's hair had been dark red instead of black, but he'd had that same skinny build and angular face and the same freckles, yeah. Both Pags and Bobby with that Opie Taylor spray of freckles across the cheeks and the bridge of the nose. Or maybe it was just because when someone dies, you think about the past. The past. Fucking past. Now the Caprice was down to 20 miles an hour and the traffic stopped dead farther up just shy of exit 9, but Sully still didn't notice. On WKND, the oldies station, question mark, and the Mysterians were singing 96 Tears, and he was thinking about walking down the center aisle of the chapel with Diefenbaker in front of him, walking up to the coffin for his first look at Pagano while the canned hymns played. Abide with me was the current ditty wafting through the air above Pagano's corpse. Pags, who had been perfectly happy to sit for hours with the .50 caliber propped up beside him and his pack on his lap and the deck of Winston's parked in the strap of his helmet playing Going Up the Country over and over again. Any resemblance to Bobby Garfield was long gone, Sully saw as he looked into the coffin. The mortician had done a job good enough to justify the open coffin. But Peg still had the loose-skinned, sharp-chinned look of a fat man who has spent his final months on the cancer diet, the one they never write up in the National Enquirer, the one that consists of radiation injected chemical poisons in all the potato chips you want. Remember the harmonicas? Diefenbaker asked. I remember, Sully said. I remember everything. He came out sounding weird, and Diefenbaker glanced at him. Sully had a clear, fierce flash of how Dief had looked on that day in the Ville when Malenfant, Clemson, and those other Nimrods had all of a sudden started paying off the morning's terror. The whole last week's terror. They wanted to put it somewhere. The howls in the night and the sudden mortar shots and finally the burning copters that had fallen with their rotors still turning, dispersing the smoke of their own deaths as they dropped. Down they came. Wacko! And the little men in the black pajamas were shooting at Delta 2-2 and Bravo 2-1 from the bush just as soon as the Americans ran out into the clearing. Sully had run with Willie Sherman beside him on the right and Lieutenant Packer in front of him. Then Lieutenant Packer took a round in the face, and no one was in front of him. Ronnie Malenfant was on his left, and Malenfant had been yelling in his high-pitched voice on and on and on. He was like some mad high-pressure telephone salesman gorted out on amphetamines. Come on, you fucking ringmeats. Come on, you slopey joes. Shoot me, you fucks. You fucking fucks can't shoot for shit. Pagano was behind them, and Slocum was beside Pags. Some Bravo guys, but mostly Delta boys. That was his memory. Willie Sherman yelled for his own guys, but a lot of them hung back. Delta 2-2 didn't hang back. Clemson was there, and Walensky and Hackermeyer, and it was amazing how he could remember their names. Their names and the smell of that day. The smell of the green and the smell of the kerosene. The sight of the sky blue on green, and oh man, how they would shoot, how those little fuckers could shoot. You never forgot how they would shoot, or the feel of a round passing close beside you, and Malenfant was screaming, shoot me, you dead-ass ringmeats, can't fucking blind, come on, I'm right here, fucking blind, I homo slope-head assholes, I'm right here. And the men in the downed helicopters were screaming, so they pulled them out, got the foam on the fire and pulled them out, only they weren't men anymore. Not what you'd call men. They were screaming TV dinners for the most part. TV dinners with eyes and belt buckles and these clittery reaching fingers with smoke rising from the melted nails. Yeah, like that. That stuff you could tell people like Dr. Conroy. When you pulled them, parts of them came off, kind of slid off, the way the baked skin of a freshly cooked turkey will slide along the hot liquefied fat just beneath like that. And all the time, you're smelling the green and the kerosene. It's all happening. It's a really, really big shoe, as Ed Sullivan used to say. And it's all happening on our stage. And all you can do is roll with it. Try to get over. That was the morning. That was the helicopters, and something like that had to go somewhere. When they got to the shitty little Ville that afternoon, they still had the stink of charred helicopter crew members in their noses. The old lieutenant was dead, and some of the men, Ronnie Malenfant and his friends, if you wanted to get right down to particulars, had gone a little bug house. Diefenbaker was the new lieutenant, and all at once he had found himself in charge of crazy men who wanted to kill everyone they saw. Children, old men, old mamasans in red Chinese sneakers. The copters crashed at 10. At approximately 2:05, Ronnie Malenfant first stuck his bayonet into the old woman's stomach and then announced his intention of cutting off the fucking pig's head. At approximately 4:15, less than 4 clicks away, the world blew up in John Sullivan's face. That had been his big day in Donghua province, his really big shoe. Standing there between two shacks at the head of the Ville's single street, Diefenbaker had looked like a scared 16-year-old kid, but he hadn't been 16, he'd been 25, years older than Sully and most of the others. The only other man there of Dief's age and rank was Willie Sherman, and Willie seemed reluctant to step in. Perhaps the rescue operation that morning had exhausted him, or perhaps he had noticed that once again it was the Delta 2-2 boys who were leading the charge. Malenfant was screaming that when the fucking slope-head Kong saw a few dozen heads up on sticks, they'd think twice about fucking with Delta Lightning. On in that shrill, drilling phone salesman's voice of his, the card player, Mr. Card Shark.